From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. Partisan gerrymandering, drawing congressional and legislative maps to benefit one political party, is almost as old as American democracy, but it's still being debated across the country. Pennsylvania's Supreme Court has just thrown out the state's congressional map and drawn a new one. The old map, the court ruled, was gerrymandered to favor Pennsylvania Republicans. And the U.S. Supreme Court is considering the constitutionality of the map in Wisconsin. During oral arguments last October, Justice Sonia Sotomayor directed a pointed question to Aaron Murphy, who was arguing for the Wisconsin State Senate.
Tell me what the value is to democracy from political gerrymandering. How does that help our system of government?
And we'll tackle that question this hour on Point. How should states draw their voting districts? You can join us on air or online. Has your congressional map been redrawn? How does it look to you? How should voting districts be determined? And joining me now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is Liz Navratil. She covers the Pennsylvania state government for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Liz, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And from Arlington, Virginia, we're joined by David Wasserman. He is the U.S. House editor for the Cook Political Report and a contributor to 538. David is one of the country's leading experts on gerrymandering, and welcome to On Point, David.
Thanks.
First of all, how would you answer that question, David, from Sotomayor? What is the value, if any, to democracy from gerrymandering? How do you describe this phenomenon? What's its history?
Well, it's kind of like asking, why do some people drink too much? Parties gerrymander because they can. And the reason gerrymandering is so hard to eradicate is because reformers can't agree on how to fix it. And what is the definition of a fair map? That's kind of a harder question to answer than you know, what is an unfair map? And is it one that aims to award a proportional share of seats to votes? Is it one that maximizes competitive districts? Is it one that disregards partisanship altogether? And the answer is it's really in the eye of the beholder. And there's no question Pennsylvania's Republican map that was struck down this week didn't meet any of those definitions. It was a really aggressive partisan gerrymander. But the map that replaced it, that was handed down by the court, was not necessarily blind to partisanship either. It made some conscious choices that helped Democrats compensate for their natural geographic disadvantage in that state. And that ruling wouldn't have been possible had it not been for some key state Supreme Court races in 2015 where Democrats won a majority on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So the reason you won't see a broad sweeping eradication of Republican-drawn gerrymanders in other states is that in other states, there's simply not that majority on a judicial body with that power.
Okay, you've covered a lot of points there, a lot of territory, David, and we're going to revisit those. But let's consider the situation in the specific situation in Pennsylvania and in some other states. First of all, here's Fox News correspondent Doug McElway describing some of the oddly drawn congressional districts in the country.
Goofy kicking Donald Duck is one description of Pennsylvania's Republican-held 7th District. Observers say North Carolina's 12th District, straddling Interstate 85, is so narrow you could open your car doors and kill everybody in it.
And as far as Pennsylvania is concerned, Pennsylvania's Republican House Speaker Mike Terzai questioned the timing of the recent challenges to the state's congressional map.
They should have challenged these maps after 2011, and they're challenging them now. And then a 5-2 Democratic vote on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court invalidates our map. It's completely wrong.
And let's go now to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to Liz Navratil. So, Liz, is this a done deal now? The Supreme Court in state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania has thrown out the old map, come up with a new one. Is this story over, or do the Republicans there, like Mike Terzai, still have some options? Is there still some fight they'd like to wage?
They would definitely like to continue fighting. Our indications, even just a couple moments ago, are that Mike Terzai and one of his colleagues in the Senate are definitely going to file an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's very likely some others might be trying to file an appeal in one of the U.S. district courts in Pennsylvania to try and get at it from a different angle. The big question is, how successful are they going to be in those appeals? And predicting the courts is not always an easy business.
Right. And if that map were to stand, how soon would it take effect? Would it take effect in time for the midterm elections this year?
It would be in place for our primary, which is in mid-May.
That's amazing that it can be done that quickly.
And that was one of the big arguments from some of the folks who fought the old map, that they said, look, it is possible to turn this around given all of the technology we have and all of the computer programs that can spit out these files very quickly.
David Wasserman, have you determined, have you looked at the voting districts in Pennsylvania and determined to what effect this new map would have? How would it change, if any, the sort of the leaning districts, the way you calculate which districts lean to which party, if this new map was to actually take effect in time for the midterm elections this fall?
The old Republican map generated a 13-5 seat Republican majority in each election since 2012, the first time it was in place, even in cases when Republicans won a minority of votes cast for House. And in part, that was a product of Democrats' concentration of voters in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, which is really inefficient for winning a majority of districts in the state to begin with. But clearly, a lot of it had to do with the choices Republicans made in drawing the map. Now, the new map still preserves six opportunities for Democrats to pick up seats. That, you know, let's be honest, Democrats did have opportunities to pick up to six Republican seats under the old map just because they're doing really well in 2018. But what it does is it makes the quality of those pickup opportunities a whole lot better. So, for example, one open Republican seat in the Lehigh Valley of Allentown and Bethlehem, it used to be a district that went for Trump by 8 points. Now, under the new map, it's a district that went for Hillary Clinton by one. So Democrats have a much better chance at picking up that seat.
Liz, does that David's calculation jibe with what you're thinking as well?
That is very consistent with what we're hearing from a lot of the folks in Pennsylvania who watch different elections and try and predict which way they're going to go. I think the big thing that we have been hearing is sort of this argument of, okay, if the Democrats are clustered in the larger cities, should the court be breaking up those areas to allow for some sort of balance between how people vote statewide and how they vote regionally, and to try and account for that? And the answer to that is probably going to run along party lines, depending on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
I have one question, and either one of you can probably answer it, and that is, I'm a little confused about how the courts, how the court jurisdictions came down in this case, because I know there was a federal circuit court ruling on the voting district boundaries in January, and then of course we have this state Supreme Court ruling, and those rulings were in two different directions, weren't they? Liz, can you explain why is it that the state Supreme Court had jurisdiction in this case as opposed to the federal court that ruled on it earlier?
So the state Supreme Court, when it made its decision, said it was doing it on the basis of the Pennsylvania Constitution as opposed to the United States Constitution. And there are some differences in how the two approach some of the key issues at play in these cases. Now, the state Supreme Court has a Democratic majority. The Republicans, who by and large tend not to like what the state Supreme Court did, have argued that because these are federal elections, that the U.S. Constitution should be the dominant document used to help weigh one way or the other. So I guess we'll kind of see as all these appeals go, you know, which courts tend to favor in which direction.
But the, I mean, to what extent is this a settled matter? I mean, is the, I think that Justice Alito has already rejected a Supreme Court reconsideration of the state Supreme Court ruling, correct? I mean, is there still some sort of question here of which court might prevail?
Yes. So we had asked the same question of Speaker Mike Turgeon, essentially. Why do you think this new effort would be successful given that the last one wasn't? His answer was that he thinks it has to do with the sort of ripeness of the case, meaning that because there is now a map in place, they might have further ground or more success in their appeals. That being said, there are a lot of outside experts and some also on the Democratic side who think that a talking point that's probably not going to succeed ultimately when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court deciding whether or not to take this up.
And Liz, is there still talk of trying to impeach those state Supreme Court justices who, as Terzai said, you know, a Democratic majority, is there still some talk of trying to impeach them for ruling the way they did?
There is some talk about that. Right now, the way it stands is that one of the state representatives has introduced what is called a co-sponsorship memo to try to impeach some of the justices. Now, this co-sponsorship memo is sort of the step you take before you introduce legislation. So essentially, what they're doing is sort of taking the temperature to try and figure out if they would have enough support to push through legislation. So that's something that we're all going to be watching in the coming days and weeks to see whether they really do attempt to do this or whether this is something that's simply being floated out there.
Are there any polls, Liz, that sort of show how Pennsylvania voters across the board consider this? Are they, you know, are they happy that these boundaries are being redrawn? Was there some sort of a sense that the old ones were unfair?
You know, if there are, I haven't seen them since the new map came out. I think right now a lot of people are still trying to digest what exactly is in the map. A lot of the work that is being done, we're still trying to fill in gaps as reporters for voters who are trying to figure out, I live in this area, am I in this district, or am I in this district?
Good enough. Okay, Liz Navratil is a state government reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks for joining us today, Liz. This is On Point.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This, with the recommendation for another podcast for you to check out, namely How I Built This. Every week, I talk to the people behind some of the most inspiring companies and brands in the world, with stories of incredible persistence, grit, and insight. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, and we're talking about political gerrymandering, drawing districts deliberately to benefit one political party. You can join our conversations. What do you think are some of the forces behind gerrymandering in the United States? Racism, perhaps? Partisanship? Do you think judges should rule on the issue? Do you live in an oddly drawn district? My guest is David Wasserman. He's the U.S. House editor for the Cook Political Report and a contributor to 538. And joining me now from Norman, Oklahoma, is Keith Gaddy. He's a professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma. He provided redistricting consultation to Wisconsin Republicans in 2011, and he's filed an amicus brief in the case over that state's districts that is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Keith, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Ted. Good to be here.
It's Tom, but that's all right.
Oh, Tom, I'm sorry. I was thinking about the person in front of me. My apologies.
I'm not offended. But first, back to you, David, because you made a point that I want to revisit. In this first part of this hour, we are talking about the situation in Pennsylvania. And I think you said earlier that we shouldn't generalize too much from the situation, from the outcome in Pennsylvania, because basically every gerrymandering case is different, right?
That's right. And this is really going to be in the hands of the Supreme Court, which has struggled for years to define partisan gerrymandering and rein it in. And we'll see if they can come up with a workable standard when it rules on the cases out of Wisconsin and Maryland. But this is very, very tough to adjudicate.
And Keith Gaddy, you are as much of an expert on that as anyone is. Am I correct that you essentially have sort of, in a sense, argued for both sides in this Wisconsin case that is before the Supreme Court?
Well, not exactly. I'll give it to you in brief. Okay. I was retained by the state of Wisconsin in 2010 to provide data services for the state legislature. And I had previously testified for Wisconsin in 2002 in federal court when the federal court was going to draw a map for the Wisconsin General Assembly. So what happened in Wisconsin was I provided data services and especially consulting on voting rights districts in the state of Wisconsin for Milwaukee County, and to ensure that those districts would perform on behalf of minority voters. I had also developed a measure of partisanship that had been previously used in Wisconsin in 2002 to be available to the legislature, and they had access to that and to those data when they drew their maps. But I didn't actually draw any maps. Now, I did not defend this map when it got into partisan gerrymandering. I had exited this industry and was not involved in that case. And after the district court decision came down, my colleague Bernie Groffman called me up and said, I'm working on an amicus. I think we can articulate a standard for partisan gerrymandering. Do you want to join me? And I joined him. So the amicus brief I've filed on behalf of neither party represents what we see as a three-pronged test to attempt to identify partisan gerrymanders. And we do think that the courts can take these on, that there is a serviceable standard and a legal theory that can be applied.
Well, that is really quite an achievement if you've pulled that off, because this is something that has been debated for a long time, whether there is any way to draw a neutral standard for coming up with the boundaries of voting districts. It's been a tough one, hasn't it been?
Well, it is, Tom. And the thing is, I don't know, you know, as Dave pointed out earlier, it's tough. Every districting scheme is different. There are background effects that exist in every state. In both Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania, there are latent Republican biases in the distribution of population. And in Pennsylvania, you have what is basically a 10-8 map, but it still takes some steps to extend beyond what a true neutral factor map would look like. Now, what we've articulated is not the way you draw a fair map. We've articulated what you look for to find a partisan gerrymander. And there are basically three parts of the test in brief, which is the map symmetrical? Is the map responsive? And is there a lack of partisan intent in the drawing of the map? So if you have a map that, let's put it this way, if we look at symmetry, if one party gets 53% of the vote and gets 58% of the seats, if the other party gets 53% of the vote, they also ought to get 58% of the seats. Responsiveness means that if there's a change in the partisan balance in the state and partisan preferences, the map should respond accordingly and you should have the ability to change majorities. And then intent is a variety of direct or indirect indications that there is partisan effect, intent at work by the map makers. They intended to discriminate against the disadvantaged party. And it's this space right here where we have to find a legal theory to carry gerrymandering in order to allow the courts to act.
And David Wasserman, you've done some work on this issue as well, sort of playing out different scenarios for drawing voting districts. And Keith just suggested different criteria that you could use. You could try to find districts that sort of look the same, that are geographically sensible, or you could deliberately come up with a voting district map that sort of is proportional in terms of the political forces in the state. Now, how do you, between these different criteria, how is a state government or a court going to decide which criteria are the ones that should rule?
The age-old question. And at 538, we undertook a project. It took 6 months, but we redrew the country 7 different ways, every one of our state's congressional districts, according to 7 different criteria. One of them was proportional representation. A lot of people say, well, the fair way to do this is to award seats in proportion to parties' share of the vote, and that sounds good. But geography makes that really difficult. For example, in Keith's home state of Oklahoma, Democrats win, you know, on average about 40% of the vote, Republicans over 60%. But if you were to allocate three of Oklahoma's 5 seats to Republicans and 2 to Democrats, you couldn't, because to get to even one Democratic-leaning seat, you'd have to draw a district that snakes from Oklahoma City through Stillwater to Tulsa. Mm. And that's not a compact map. So what criteria do you use? And that's very difficult especially in an era when we're so polarized on the map.
Well, it's no wonder that the Supreme Court, on the one hand, it's no wonder the Supreme Court has decided to take this on because it is so essential. On the other hand, it's got to be a very tough case for the justices to deal with. Let's consider the Wisconsin situation now that is before the court. The Supreme Court is considering a lawsuit that challenges Wisconsin's legislative map over partisan gerrymandering. Bill Whitford is the plaintiff in the case. He spoke with the PBS NewsHour in October.
The value that's clearly at stake is that majorities should rule. Democrats
got a majority of the statewide assembly vote, and they got less than 40% of the seats in the assembly. I mean, that made very clear we had no chance.
Okay, so Bill Whitford's principle that he thinks should be applied is that majorities should rule. Meanwhile, on the other side, the Supreme Court heard arguments on that redistricting plan, and arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin was Attorney General Brad Scheimel. And here he is outside the Supreme Court after the arguments.
Our legislature followed traditional redistricting criteria, which is what they've been required to do, and we believe they followed that, and we think the justices will agree. The plaintiffs have not yet provided any kind of clear, precise, and neutral standard that the court can apply to all districting maps across the United States.
And that's the question, isn't it? Is there a clear, precise, and neutral standard that the U.S. Supreme Court can apply to all districting maps across the United States? Keith Getty, do you want to make a prediction about how the court is likely to view this question?
Well, we say always, always explain, never predict. I'm not a forecaster like Nate Silver, so I won't quite go that far. But Nate's dad, Brian's a friend of mine, so I love your all's work at 538. If I were to guess right now, I think that I do think that Justice Kennedy has been persuaded, which means there's five votes to articulate a standard. And if they're going to do this, what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to find a vehicle through equal protection to make this happen. And if you look back at previous redistricting cases, we look back at the one-person, one-vote cases from the 1960s, the argument was where you live shouldn't dictate the weight and value of your vote. If you live in Tolliver County, Georgia, with 900 people, as opposed to Fulton County, Georgia, with 400,000, your vote shouldn't be worth 100 times as much in Tolliver County. So that's how we end up with one person, one vote. When it came to the racial redistricting cases, what we concluded was if you live in an environment where you have racially polarized voting, where the white vote block votes against black vote preferences, and you can draw a district that's generally compact for a minority group to be the majority, you should draw it as a remedy. And again, it's about equal protection and equal access and equal opportunity to participate in the process. When we look at partisanship, it used to be the argument, and this was made in Pennsylvania by the lawyers for the Pennsylvania legislature. The argument was, well, partisanship's not stable. You've got split ticket voting, and people swing their vote back and forth. And if you had asked me 20 years ago, I would have said, yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense. This is one of the reasons why we have a hard time legally undoing a partisan gerrymander. But then you get to think about who is injured in terms of their individual rights through a partisan gerrymander. And what is injured is exactly what the plaintiff in Wisconsin has brought up, which is the ability to change majorities and allow majorities to rule. It's one of the foundational principles of American democracy, this thing right here, that majorities should be able to govern and you should be able to have a change of majority through your electoral system. If a system of districts is designed to lock in the majority in an initial election and prevent a change in majority preference from being able to take over, you've discriminated against a variety of voters. In particular, you've discriminated against both the minority party at the time, but also those voters who have changing preferences. And now we have an equal protection problem. And that is why I think that there are legs for this challenge in the Supreme Court.
Well, we actually have a listener who is in Wisconsin and listening to our program. Nate is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, what are your thoughts on this issue of gerrymandering in your state of Wisconsin?
I hope that the Wisconsin map gets torn up. My feeling of gerrymandering, having experienced it for the last several years, is that gerrymandering itself is an attack on democracy and a travesty, and putting basically partisanship above democracy and above honest elections. I feel that our attorney general here puts partisanship above the law. But as dealing with the actual voters, it's taking away the ability for people to choose. It's not just hurting one particular party, but it's actually hurting those swing voters as well, who sometimes are the decision makers over who should rule. It is something that I think this country would do well to be rid of.
And that is Nate's view from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. So David Wasserman, Nate is basically suggesting here that gerrymandering undermines democracy. You mentioned before, you know, what this new map is likely to do in Pennsylvania. Have you considered the country as a whole? If all gerrymandered districts were done away with across the country, what kind of effect it would have on the makeup of the U.S. Congress? Does the Republican Party have a disproportionate benefit at this point from gerrymandering, and how would that change if, for example, the Supreme Court were to rule in this case and we saw sort of a realignment across the country?
Well, gerrymandering is often blamed for just about all forms of dysfunction in Washington, but I'd argue that it's a contributor, but not the sole culprit to our dysfunction. But look, Democrats are finally waking up to their disadvantage in districting thanks to a confluence of two trends over the past decade. And the first was that Republicans won an enormous victory in 2010 right before the round of redistricting and won four times as much power to redraw boundaries. You know, Democrats and Republicans, I think, have equally engaged in as egregious forms of gerrymandering in the past, but Republicans won four times as much power to do so in 2010. But the other part of it is that Democrats have increasingly clustered all over the country in cities and college towns in places that are 80 to 20 or 90 to 10 for Democrats, and that really hurts them when it comes to winning majorities of districts. And in Wisconsin, Democrats have the same problem that Democrats in Pennsylvania do. They're clustered in Madison and Milwaukee, and they're winning those places overwhelmingly. But when it comes to winning a majority in a legislative body, that just doesn't work.
And Keith Gaddy, isn't it true that some of this so-called gerrymandering happens naturally? I mean, I've read that people tend to move into communities of like mind. You know, I mean, is there sort of some redistricting that just takes place on its own as a result of people's choices about where they want to live?
Yeah, my fellow Louisvillian Bill Bishop talked about this in his book, The Big Sort, that birds of a feather flock together. And, you know, as Americans, we've started clustering together. And I think David has articulated this effectively, that when we look at if you're living in a diverse community, you're probably a Democrat, a diverse urban community. If you're living in a college town, you're probably a Democrat. If you're living in a predominantly Black or Hispanic community, you're probably a Democrat. And we do have a tendency to cluster together based upon lifestyle. And, you know, one thing that we've always known as map makers is that if we have newer construction with bigger houses that are farther apart, we're probably getting Republicans and probably getting Republican voters. We don't have to look deep to find this. Probably about half of the polarization in American politics arises because of this natural sorting. And as David points out, it makes it very difficult to draw competitive districts that are also compact that follow traditional redistricting criteria.
Hmm. Let's go now to Paul, who's on the line from Iowa with his own story of how Iowans have dealt with gerrymandering. Paul, thanks for calling On Point. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. George Will has famously bragged up our system in Iowa.
Okay.
We have a bipartisan commission that draws the districts in Iowa. That helps clean up our politics. Also, we don't elect judges in Iowa. They're appointed by an organization out of the Bar Association. And then we vote to retain them periodically. But I think these two ingredients kind of clean up our politics a little in here in Iowa. It's a great thing not to have the legislature do the districts.
So you have and how is that independent commission appointed?
I'm not real clear on that. I just know that it exists.
Yep.
And I know that gerrymandering is not a problem in Iowa because of that.
Okay. Well, I bet David Wasserman has some answers to that. David, are you familiar with this independent commission that is responsible for drawing up districts in Iowa? And is that a model for other states?
For sure. Well, look, it's not actually an independent commission.
Okay.
It's a Bureau of Legislative Services in Iowa that proposes maps. It's essentially a bureaucratic function. And then the legislature has the power to accept or reject those maps. And Iowa keeps counties whole in the process. It's a little simpler than it is in other states because Iowa's got 99 square counties where you can form districts fairly easily. It doesn't have any Voting Rights Act or minority rights considerations compared to other states. So it's very difficult to apply that model everywhere. But one wonders after a while, why can't we do this like other countries do this? After all, Canada and the UK make this a fairly simple bureaucratic function handled by judges or appointees removed from politics.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and maybe after that break we can go back, we can go into that question of how other countries handle this challenge. We're talking about political gerrymandering in the United States. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to WBUR.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's WBUR.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, and we're talking about gerrymandering and redistricting in the United States. You can join our conversation. Do you think there's a way to fix gerrymandering, or do you think it's too embedded in our political system to repair? And one of the things that we have heard so far is that there are two elements in gerrymandering that make the practice controversial. One is when minority voters are put together in such a way, or minority areas are put together in such a way as to suppress the minority vote. The other one is when gerrymandering is done for partisan advantage. The first case, the kind of racially based gerrymandering, is what's been at stake in North Carolina. Last summer, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that North Carolina lawmakers racially gerrymandered two congressional districts after the 2010 census. In May, North Carolina Democratic Congressman G.K. Butterfield spoke to reporters in support of the high court's decision.
The court must rein in the Republicans or any political party that's in the majority. We have legislators who are choosing their districts and not the other way around. The voters should choose their legislators.
And David Wasserman, is there any sense that one or the other type of gerrymandering here is more egregious? You know, is are courts more likely to challenge a apparent racial gerrymandering as opposed to more partisan gerrymandering?
Often they're difficult to distinguish. And in North Carolina, Republicans used the guise of the Voting Rights Act to create two majority African-American districts in 2011 that had the effect of packing Democratic voters into a select few districts, and they ended up winning a 10-3 majority in seats that still holds today. Now, Democrats got behind a lawsuit filed by several African-American plaintiffs. They overturned the map. And even though North Carolina's lines were regularized a bit by the legislature and those minority districts dismantled, Republicans still ended up with a 10-3 majority simply by essentially drawing fences around Charlotte and the Raleigh-Durham and Chapel Hill areas. So Democrats would argue that it's still a gerrymandered map, but the lines between racial gerrymandering and partisan gerrymandering have been blurred. And the Supreme Court really has to tackle the partisanship question if Democrats are going to get anywhere.
And Keith Gaddy, just very briefly here, what are the constitutional issues here? Because isn't it true that the Constitution largely leaves it up to states to sort of run their own elections? And, you know, what's the threshold above which the federal government needs to get involved?
Well, where the federal government gets involved is in any instance where the actions of the state have served to discriminate against the ability of the individual to obtain equal protection. And if you look at voting rights issues, you couldn't bank on the state's act in good faith. And I've written two books on the Voting Rights Act that deal with this. The reason we have strong voting rights laws in the United States, and we used to have stronger voting rights laws in the United States, is that you couldn't bank on the state's act in good faith. And so Congress comes in through their Article I authority and incorporation through the 14th Amendment and regulates the vote and sets a set of standards by which we can go to court and sue to have our 14th and 15th Amendment rights protected. So we have to meet a high evidentiary standard, and the discrimination often has to be pretty egregious. Pity poor North Carolina. They are in court every 2 years for the last 27 years, and they really just need to they just need to contract Sandy O'Connor to come in and draw their districts and be done with it, because she's the only person that understands how to do them for them, evidently.
Well, it's a lot at stake in North Carolina, isn't it? This is one of those purple states that can go either way, and I'm sure that how the districts are drawn might have a big impact.
Well, it and Florida are the two most competitive megastates out there, potentially, and so North Carolina, the stakes are huge. And the problem in North Carolina used to be that you didn't have enough African-American access, so you had to draw districts to facilitate that. And a Democratic legislature drew highly contorted districts to protect Democratic white incumbents and also allow black access. Those are the seats that keep getting thrown out in the 1990s. Then they start drawing districts more recently. They're packing too many black voters in. And what we're discovering is racial polarization in North Carolina isn't as high as it used to be. Hmm. So you don't need 50, 54, 55% black in a district to elect, have an equal opportunity to elect. You can do it with far, far smaller percentages. But Congress locked in majority vote remedies under the Voting Rights Act in the 2006 Voting Rights Act renewal. So there is a concerted effort that's come from Republicans for 27 years. It's called the Black Max Strategy, to lock up as many black voters in as few districts as possible, to leave behind as many good districts as possible for Republicans.
Hmm. Let's go now to Mike, who's on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Mike, you have called On Point. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I think while the points are good in a case law political sense, the most dangerous thing people are facing is the result of these partisanship gerrymanderings. What ends up happening is these districts become one party dominates and the real race is the primary, and you end up with the polarization gridlock in Congress when there's no chance of the other party winning and the primary is your only election. You're going to get a race to the extremes, and what happens, we're seeing it, what happens in Congress when the extremes win, the result is gridlock. Yes, the gentleman from 538 has excellent points in his podcast that I'd highly recommend on the issues. However, the result is absolute devastation. It was different 20 years ago because we didn't have computerized maps going house by house by house. Now, you have safe districts and the rise of pure partisan Tea Party politics that, frankly, Republicans have taken advantage because the majority's in 2010.
Yep.
The result is gridlock. And that will not be ignored by the court.
Well, David Wasserman, Mike raises a really good point. I mean, we've seen both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, pushed to the extreme of each of their own constituency and with a much weakened territory in the middle, right? Is Mike correct that this is perhaps in large part due to gerrymandered districts?
Well, I don't disagree with the premise that the real problem in Washington is gridlock, driven by the demand of that primaries put upon members of Congress to run to the extremes. But we actually undertook a review of the partisanship of House districts over the last 20 years. What we found at the Cook Political Report was that, yes, the number of swing districts within 5 points of the national outcome, that diminished from 164 to 72 between 1997 and 2017, so 56% decline. But 82% of that was the result of the natural geographic polarization of the electorate over that time span. Only 17% of that was the result of redistricting year changes. So that's one myth. And I think it also helps explain why the Senate has become so polarized. And we don't gerrymander. There's no gerrymandering in the Senate. And then the second point, there's a misconception that technology is to blame for the rise of, you know, hyper-partisan redistricting and for the effectiveness of redistricting. And actually, what's made redistricting so much more effective is that sorting. Once voters have self-segregated into like-minded neighborhoods, it's easier than ever for the partisans in charge of the process to put them in heavily red or heavily blue districts. And 61% of American voters now live in counties that voted for either party's nominee in 2016 by 20 points or more. That's a 23-point increase over where we were in 1992.
And that's what, Keith Gatta, you mentioned that book about the big sort. That's what you were referring to, that some of this is just happens sort of voluntarily, I guess.
Yeah, and the thing is it's going to be ongoing because in the last 10 years, Americans have become less likely to move around the country and less likely to relocate. We're now kind of settling into place as well. And part of that also has to do with the ongoing issues with regard to the housing market in terms of the ability to access finance and also the increase in housing costs that are occurring that are preventing mobility. But yeah, it's once we know where we are, we tend to stay there. And it's funny, there's a guy at University of Texas, Dallas, Thomas Burnell, who wrote a book where he argued that safe districts were better because more people were getting a representative they liked, that they would agree with a representative. I've read Tom's book, and I know Tom, and Tom and I get along very well. I don't agree with that, however. I think that we need to have constituencies that allow for responsiveness, and we've had the technology for a long time to do this. We've been doing this for 30 years. The problem here is single-member districts with first-across-the-post election. If we were to do what the Irish did and have multi-member districts with single transferable vote, or to use varying forms of majority vote or preference systems or multi-member districts, we'd get different types of representatives and we'd have different types of voting opportunities. The thing is, since 1842, Congress has not allowed us to have multi-member districts in the for the U.S. House, and the number of multi-member districts in the state legislature has gone from 55% of all state legislative districts in 1960 to less than 5% now. So the chances just aren't there to select a menu of representatives.
Yeah, and David Wasserman suggested earlier that we should consider what other countries are doing in this regard, and I think one of our callers has a question about that as well. Dalton is on the line from Lexington, Kentucky. Dalton, you've called On Point. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My point is kind of similar to the last guy. I think he's hitting on something that's really, really important to our political system. But I think all of this, the polarization of our parties and the problem of gerrymandering we're having, is they're all symptoms of the bipartisan system. And, you know, you guys talked about how other democracies aren't running into this problem. And it's because most other democracies don't only have two parties. And I think all of this is a symptom of us not having a politically diversified government.
All right. Thanks, Dalton. David, Keith mentioned the possibility of the option of having multi-member districts. And Dalton suggests that maybe if part of the problem is that we've got this kind of bipolar political system of just two parties to choose from. You had mentioned earlier in this hour that we should look at what other countries are doing for some inspiration here. What are your thoughts about what other countries can teach us in terms of how to deal with this issue?
Well, in Canada, for example, there are provincial commissions where judges preside over a redistricting process to reallocate ridings. Tends not to generate very much controversy. In the UK, there are boundary readjustment commissions in every member state and member nation, and we don't have a parliamentary system where, you know, if the Libertarians, for example, were to win 2% of votes for House races, they would win 2% of seats. So that does handicap third parties. And the kinds of changes that that Keith is talking about with regard to multi-member districts, I think they'd have overall a positive outcome. We could have Republicans elected from Massachusetts or Democrats elected from Utah, but it is such a radical change from our current system, and there are concerns about minority access to districts that I don't think it's likely.
Hmm. One question I have, David, and maybe Keith has a thought on this as well. You mentioned that this big swing, in terms of partisan gerrymandering, partly had to do with the triumph of Republicans in the 2010 election and how that advantage that they achieved in that election, you know, worked for them when it came time to redistrict based on the 2010 census. We have another census coming up in 2020. We have midterm elections coming up in 2018. Are we likely to see this issue of gerrymandering resolved before we get to the 2020 census, or are the effects of the 2010 census likely to influence the boundaries of our voting districts, you know, for another 15 years or so?
The census is becoming a political football in itself. Democrats don't trust the Trump administration to administer it fairly, and that's become a big issue. But what happens after the census? And does the Supreme Court lay out guidelines to combat partisan gerrymandering? If they were to adopt the three-prong test that Keith laid out, or another test that's been proposed by the plaintiffs, the efficiency gap, it could create more questions than it resolves because there are subjective aspects to each of those prongs. And I suspect you'll see a bonanza for redistricting lawyers and litigation across a variety of states.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Keith?
Well, in brief, I think Dave's exactly right. In fact, I've sat here throughout the hour, and every time I had a thought about a question, Dave articulated what I was going to see. It's wonderful to find a like-minded person. The critical thing for the Democrats is to quit worrying about winning the U.S. Senate and start worrying about winning state legislatures. For the cost of winning a Senate seat in Georgia, which they're not going to do, they can win back several state legislatures with the swing of just a few million dollars. The next set of gubernatorial midterms are very important because if you get a seat at the table, you force moderation in your districts, whether you have a governorship or at least one legislative chamber. What's going to happen with partisan gerrymandering if we affect a standard is constantly coming up. And we are going to keep litigating them. And in a nutshell, I think the judges like these cases because they like politics. The justices like to see these. They're interesting. And I think they like to keep control over this process. And that's why we've never had a hard and fast racial redistricting standard. We'd be headed down the same road with partisan gerrymandering standards. But the truth is, if you look at the one-person cases, like the Larios case in Georgia, you look at the partisan gerrymandering cases, the racial gerrymandering cases, they're really partisan gerrymandering cases. We just don't call them that.
Well, we shouldn't close out this hour without mentioning that President Trump has actually weighed in on the gerrymandering issue with respect to Pennsylvania. He's tweeted, "Hope Republicans in the great state of Pennsylvania challenge the new congressional map all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. Your original was correct. Don't let the Democrats, the Dems, take elections away from you so they can raise taxes and waste money." A pretty partisan analysis of the gerrymandering issue there from the president himself. So our guests today have been David Wasserman. He is the U.S. House editor of the Cook Political Report and a contributor to 538. You can find a link to his reporting on gerrymandering at our website, onpointradio.org. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And Keith Gaddy, a professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma. Keith, we appreciate your time today.
Tom, it's been a pleasure. Take care.
It's been a pleasure for us as well. And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.